I'm calling to order this meeting of the House Committee on Children, Families, Finance, and Policy. We're a bit short of a quorum, a number of folks running late, but that is okay. We'll catch up as we go. So what we're going to do is begin with the first of our two bills. So the bills today, members and members of the public, are the two budget bills in our committee's area of jurisdiction for Department of Human Services and Department of Education. And so what we're going to do is first have the budget bill for DHS, and we'll bring that up. And then once we have a quorum, we'll be able to formally have that in front of us and have an amendment. And so I'll invite, I think Assistant Commissioner Brown is going to be the first, going to be walking us through the bill. So you can please make your way on up, Assistant Commissioner. Members, so this is House File 2910, and I'll just note for you that there'll be an amendment that we get to as well. We do have a lot of materials in our packets regarding these bills, including a presentation from late January that the administration provided to us. And so what I've asked the testifiers to do is not to go through the high level. There's a lot of really exciting stuff in here, and I know we're going to get into that as we go through some of the details. But I would invite members and really ask you to please take a look at the presentation dated January 26, 2023, which is a really good orientation to what we're going to be discussing. With that, Assistant Commissioner Brown, I'll ask you, if I may, to provide whatever introductory remarks you want to on 2910, and then we'll get going on walking through the bill. And welcome.
All right. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present House File 2910 today. My name is Tiki Brown. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the Department of Human Services. In January, we provided a presentation of recommendations in the Governor's One Minnesota Budget for Children and Families. House File 2910, the bill before you today, is the legislation underlying the recommendations we presented in January. This bill contains historic investments in Minnesota's children and families to ensure that they receive the support they need to build stable and thriving families and communities. Included here and are the governor's recommendations that will improve access to affordable, high-quality child care for low-income children and families, provide greater financial supports to child care providers and our child care workforce, the workforce behind our workforce, and improving our economic assistance programs for low-income children and families so that they are better at moving families from economic security to economic stability and independence. The bill also contains critical investments that will improve our prevention and family preservation services array to keep Minnesota children and their families together and reduce unacceptable racial and ethnic disparities in our child welfare system. It also provides greater financial support to our network of emergency food distribution and emergency shelter and housing providers so that we can better ensure that no family experiences food insecurity in our state, and that when homelessness occurs, it is rare, brief, and non-reoccurring. Mr. Chair and members, I will now provide a high-level walk through the bill and accompanying amendments, along with the how sections in the bill relate to the specific governor's recommendations.
And before you do that, Assistant Commissioner, so we do have a quorum, as it turns out at this point. So and I will ask, if I may, I'm going to ask Representative Lee, would you mind moving House File 2910 to bring it before the committee?
So moved.
Thank you. And then if you could move the A1 amendment.
I move the A1 amendment.
Thank you. And Assistant Commissioner Brown, can you just let us know, I think the A1 amendment, or maybe House Research would be able to provide it, but just I think it just provides some updates. Actually, maybe Ms. Mock, are you able to help us with what's in the A1 amendment? I'm not sure if you're the right person to help us with that.
Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment includes and moves some provisions from the larger DHS budget bill that belong in this committee's jurisdiction into this bill, and also makes some just cleanup and technical changes to the language.
Okay, good. Thank you. And as part of explanation, members, because we've got three different HHS committees, making sure the right provisions are in the right places has been a bit of an effort, for which I'm really super grateful to our nonpartisan staff. Any discussion of the A1 amendment? Hearing none, all in favor of approval of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, so that motion passes. And Commissioner Brown, please, yeah, begin walking us through the bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Let's see here. Okay, so the House research summary in your member packet provides a detailed summary of each section. So while I won't discuss the individual sections in many cases, but I'll highlight the groups of sections and the proposal to which they might apply. You also have a spreadsheet in your member packet that contains a copy of each provision in the bill, along with additional investments to which there is no legislative language, but a recommendation that increases the base funding levels for the existing program. So we'll move to Article 1, which is child care. Sections 1 through 3 and 32 are from the governor's proposal to change the definition of family for purposes of child care assistance program eligibility to include relative custodians, guardians, and foster parents. Expanding the definition of family would allow children in kinship and foster care situations to receive CCAP if their caregivers meet the eligibility qualifications to better ensure access to affordable child care. In doing so, if relatives who cannot afford child care, they will be more likely to serve as foster parents or kinship caregivers for a child or their family.
And I should have noted, Commissioner, for members, if you have clarifying questions along the way, I think that's okay and appropriate. We won't be doing much discussion on these bills, I'm hoping, because we're simply receiving them. So if folks do have clarifying questions that you want to ask, feel free to note that. Yeah, Representative Nelson.
Probably just back to the amendment a little bit, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
With moving, starting a new department and moving things around, trying to get everything, in the correct places, what happens when something isn't and this is passed? I mean, is there the ability of the departments to make sure that, the children are cared for as intended and, even if it's something is in DHS versus the children and families, I mean, likely we're going to be coming back in another year, moving, fixing some more stuff that's had oversight, but not really necessarily against the amendment, but I mean that's kind of what the amendment spoke to, was a lot of those things.
I think maybe Representative Nelson, we're confusing a couple different things. So this has nothing to do with the new agency.
Okay.
It has just to do with committee jurisdiction, and okay. So just verifying that everything's lining up with our committees. So okay. Yeah, thank you. So Commissioner, please continue.
Okay, members, Chair, and members, Article 1, Sections 4. 6 through 13, 15 through 19, 24 through 29, and 33 are from the governor's proposal to provide administrative improvements to child care providers. This proposal will move CCAP provider registration, renewal, and registration closure process from CCAP agencies to the Department of Human Services. It would allow, it would also reduce duplicative background studies for legal non-licensed providers by requiring them to renew their background studies every 5 years rather than every 2 years as is currently required in statute, which aligns with other provider types. Article 1, Sections 5, 32, and 33 are from the governor's proposal to permanently reprioritize the waitlist for the basic sliding fee child care program. The BSF waiting list priority order was temporarily reprioritized during the 2021 legislative session and is currently set to revert to the previous prioritization order after May 31st of 2024. This reprioritization allows families exiting MFIB to continue to receiving child care assistance so that other families on the wait list can access BSF child care, enabling the program to serve additional families and move families off the wait list more quickly. This provision goes hand in hand with the governor's proposal to provide $15 million per year in additional funding for the basic sliding fee, making it possible for counties to move families from a waiting list so that they can better afford the child care necessary to make them work or attend school. Article 1, Section 14 and 30 makes changes necessary to increase the maximum rate for child care assistance program payments to the 75th percentile, and update rates every 3 years based on the most recent market rate survey. This change will encourage more providers to accept CCAP and increase child care options for low-income families so that they can go to work or school. It will ensure that DHS is compliant with federal requirements to update the maximum rate every 3 years and set the CCAP rate at the federal benchmark for providing families receiving child care assistance with equal access to child care programs compared to families not receiving assistance. Article 1, Section 20 through 23 and 30 provides a package of supports for child care providers. Provisions include but are not limited to changes to statute allowing child care resource and referral programs to administer the one-stop regional assistance network to help establish and sustain child care programs, supports to assist economically challenged individuals with beginning a career path in child care, and a permanent child care retention payment program to help ensure child care capacity is consistently available to families throughout Minnesota. We will then move to Article 2, which is child safety and permanency.
And can you tell us that starts on page, looks like page 30?
I don't have the page number. I have sections 1 through 3, 8 through 13, and 29.
So I think, yeah, Article 2 does start on page 30, it looks like. So yeah, please continue.
Thank you. So I'll just repeat that, Mr. Chair and members. Article 2, sections 1 through 3, 8 through 13, and 29. Relate to the governor's proposal to provide better support for youth in foster care, homeless youth, and youth aging out of extended foster care. The proposal includes a number of supports for these youth, including but not limited to grants to local social service agencies, tribes, and community-based organizations to provide independent living services to eligible foster youth, grants to community-based organizations to provide services and financial support to eligible youth, and funding for a research and engagement project to consider the best method and policy supporting the preservation of the federal supplemental security income, or SSI, payments and the retirement survivors and disability insurance, RSDI, payments made on behalf of children in foster care to meet the best interests of those eligible children. Article 2, Sections 4 and 13 are part of the Governor's Family First Prevention Services Act, third phase of implementation. Family First was included in the Federal Bipartisan Budget Act of 2018, and this first implementation phases in Minnesota focus on establishing statutory requirements related to placement of children in foster care into children's residential facilities. This third phase is moving the state towards implementation of a prevention services plan to enable the state and local agencies to draw down federal Title V, 4E funding for eligible programs intended to prevent entry of family into the child welfare system. Provisions in this bill include funding for to expand the initial prevention services, support promising practices, and plan for additional services that focus on family preservation and prevention efforts. Funding for grants to local social service agencies to support infrastructure, staffing, and concrete assistance. Excellent. We then move to Article 2, Sections 5, 7, 14, and then 14 through 27. This establishes a new non-caregiver sex trafficking assessment response path, which will remove the need for contact between an alleged non-caregiver sex trafficking and the local child welfare agency, which will improve the safety outcomes for children and families and provide more victim-responsive services to trafficked youth and families. Through this new path, child welfare agencies would perform an assessment of child safety, risk of subsequent child maltreatment, and strengths and needs for the children and family. Unlike the current process, all reports of sex trafficking and sexual exploitation, contact with the alleged trafficker would be handled by law enforcement, not by the child welfare agency. Article 2, Section 6 establishes an allocation for 7 federally recognized American Indian tribes and communities in Minnesota to be used for child welfare and child protection staffing needs. This proposal is part of a package of proposals related to child welfare for American Indian families, children, and tribes. It includes funding for the department to respond in a timely way to reports of noncompliance with the Indian Child Welfare Act and the Minnesota Indian Family Preservations Act, and enables the department to provide robust technical assistance to counties for improving compliance. It also provides funding to support the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe in its ongoing efforts to join the Minnesota American Indian Child Welfare Initiative, and it provides funding for existing tribes, initiative tribes, White Earth Nation, Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, and Red Lake Nation to respond to budgetary needs.
I'm going to pause you for a second. Representative Hicks had a question.
Sure.
The one coming up.
Oh, it's the one coming up. Oh, good. Okay.
Section 7.
Anticipating. Okay. Let's, let's just Commissioner Brown.
Okay. So I have, the next section I have is Article 2, Section 28, establishing.
Hold on one second.
So do you want me to go back?
Have you already done Section 7?
Have you done lines?
If it's, I see.
From 3 through.
Let's represent six.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's okay. Yeah, so I think it looks, I saw Jennifer Sonnenfeld nodding, so it sounds like Section 7 must have been mentioned previously. So maybe just ask your question, Representative Hicks. If, yeah.
Thank you so much, Chair. So I am curious about the transition planning and the Beyond 21 program that are mentioned in these sections. I have a couple of questions about, so currently, the way current extended foster care works is that if a youth is not meeting the expectations of the case plan, they are discharged from extended foster care. And so I'm looking at this transition planning and I'm looking at the Beyond 21, but I'm not seeing any changes to any legislation or any language around the current policy in extended foster care, which requires a youth to be housed and or working or in school. And so I'm wondering how this connects to those things and subsequently, what, if any, changes are needed in the extended foster care program to make this piece work so that we aren't losing all of our youth by 21 because they aren't able to comply with the requirements?
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to bring in an expert to speak a little bit more to those details. Thank you.
Please identify yourself. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Jennifer Sommerfeld with the Department of Human Services. Representative Hicks, we have not been touching that statute as part of this bill. I think that's an interesting issue that you've raised that we can look at a different time. But this bill is intended to provide some cash for those kids that are leaving that program. It doesn't have the same work or work requirements or schooling requirements. It's just intended to try to help prevent homelessness for this particular group and give them some funding for their basic needs.
And Representative Hicks, back to you. I will note, I want to focus on the bill in front of us to clarify a question about that, but I'll let you, and then other ideas we should move on, you know, pursue in other ways too. But Representative Hicks.
Yes, thank you so much, Chair. And thank you for that. The reason I bring it up is because if the goal of this is to prevent homelessness, and we've already gotten, if we've already required housing to be a component of the previous program, then I feel like we missed a step here. So I'd like to further that conversation to ensure that we aren't creating homelessness prior to 21 also. So thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hicks, and let's definitely, please do feel free to pursue that. Commissioner Brown, continuing then?
All right. Thank you so much. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we'll move to Article 2, Section 28, which establishes a network of community resource centers with physical and virtual access points for families to support relationship-based, culturally appropriate programs, service navigation, and case management. Community resource centers will improve access to programs and services at the community level, making it easier for families to get what they need to achieving economic stability and well-being, which are linked to lower rates of child welfare involvement and neglect reporting. Community resource center grants will be available to a broad array of entities, including but not limited to community-based agencies, local governments, tribal nations, counties, school districts, community action agencies, and collaboratives, including one or more of the mentioned entity. We'll then move to Article 3, which is child support. All of these sections in this technical article make changes to the child support statute that are intended to prevent the growth of unpaid child support arrears and prevent unnecessary harm caused by enforcement methods.
And this is page 55, just for folks following along.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In addition to IT costs necessary to implement technical changes to the child support guidelines, the governor's proposal establishes funding for the department to contract with an economist to assist the agency in completing a federally required review of the child support guidelines every 4 years and funding for the federally required efforts to obtain public input while reviewing the guidelines. With that, we move to Article 4, Economic Assistance.
On page 82.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The governor's budget for children and families include a number of recommendations that support economic stability for Minnesota families. For Article 4, Sections 1 through 3, 13 through 26, 29 through 42 and parts of 44 implement the governor's proposal intended to support working Minnesotans who receive assistance from the Minnesota Family Investment Program and the General Assistance Program, or GA. This program supports work and economic stability for people receiving public assistance by setting benefit levels for 6 months rather than month to month, which will result in more income stability for low-income families who turn to these programs for help. Sections 4 through 6, 43, and parts of 44 are the governor's proposal supporting food security for Minnesotans. Specifically, Section 4 codifies new language for a SNAP outreach program in Minnesota. This proposal provides funding to support additional outreach and application assistance to Minnesotans who may be eligible for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. Section 5 modifies the Minnesota Food Shelf Program statute to allow food shelves to use grant funding to purchase personal hygiene supplies, including menstrual products and diapers. This proposal also increases base funding for the Minnesota Food Shelf Program. Section 6 establishes the American Indian Food Sovereignty Program, which provides funding for tribal nations to purchase and coordinate the distribution of nutritious food to individuals and families. Section 43 provides one-time capital for emergency food distribution facilities in Minnesota, which would provide a critical resource to renovate, upgrade, or increase space for existing facilities. Sections 7 through 12 and 27 through 28 implement changes to the Family Assets for Independence Minnesota program, commonly referred to as FAME. Changes to the FAME program in this proposal will allow tribal nations and nonprofits to administer the program with the goal to reach more diverse participants, allow participants to contribute to emergency savings account or college savings account for their children. It increases the financial match from $6,000 to $12,000 to counteract rising costs and support more families and asset acquisition. The next section I have is the A1 amendment, which I believe you covered, Mr. Chair, and would then stand for questions or turn it over to the Office of Inspector General.
And maybe I'll just note Article 5 then contains appropriations. That's on page 105. We'll have the Inspector General speak with us. Please identify yourself.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kulani Moti, and I serve as the Inspector General at the Department of Human Services. So this bill amendment includes language from the governor's budget proposal related to family child care continuous licenses. The proposal would implement a continuous license process, or a license that automatically renews for family child care license holders. Currently, family child care providers need to reapply for a license every year, which means they need to complete a new application every 1 or 2 years. The proposal will make the licensing review cycle easier for family child care license holders and licensors by reducing redundant application requirements and streamlining the licensing reapplication process. The funding in this proposal would support the infrastructure needed to do the transition to a continuous license, including IT systems costs. And to help with this transition, the department proposes to cover the initial application and annual licensing fee for family child care license holders for the first 2 years. The bill also includes funding for the governor's budget proposal related to supporting several Minnesota tribes in establishing their own fraud prevention programs. This proposal would grant seed money for the Red Lake, White Earth, and Mille Lacs tribes to establish their own fraud prevention programs, with the goal of folding in each into the statewide fraud prevention investigation program within a few years. And this proposal also includes funding for one tribal liaison between the Office of Inspector General and the tribal nations in Minnesota. I believe that's.
Thank you. And Commissioner Brown, we skipped the article on homelessness in the amendment page, starting page 9. Are you able to point us to that? I'm not sure if you're able to do that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, I can do that. Thank you.
Okay. This is page 9 of the A1 amendment, members.
Yep. Please. So I'll walk through Article 5, Section 1 adds a cross-reference to the new Safe Harbor Shelter and Housing Statute, which is established in line 10.10 of the amendment. It ensures that youth 24 years of age or younger are eligible for shelter, housing beds, and services provided to DHS to sexually exploited youth and youth at risk of sexual exploitation. Section 2, starting at line 9.8, amends the Homeless Youth Act section of statute related to street and community outreach and drop-in program. It includes specialized services for youth at risk of discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. Section 3, starting at line 10.1, revises the statute governing Homeless Youth Act provider repair and improvement grants, which were approved by the legislature during the 2022 session to permit more providers to apply and give more flexibility to the types of projects funded. It also removes the restriction that grantees cannot receive grant funds for two consecutive years. And then Section 4, starting at line 10.10, codifies the Safe Harbor Shelter and Housing Grant Program in statute. Currently, language for the program, which has permanent base funding, only exists in session law. I'll just note, in addition to these statutory provisions, the governor's budget includes recommendations to increase base funding for the Homeless Youth Act, the Safe Harbor Shelter and Housing and Emergency Services Program, the Transitional Housing Program. These funding increases are provided in the spreadsheet.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask Mr. Berg if I can. Oh, sorry, yeah, no problem. If I can, members, you received, and members of the public, we're putting on our website a spreadsheet. It's on the website. Okay, good. So the members, you got the printout of our of a spreadsheet. And Mr. Berg, I won't ask you to walk through it. Maybe you can just describe for us. So we got this, and then there's also a separate spreadsheet that contains budget recommendations both in DHS and MDE. And just if you can just sort of just tell us kind of what we have. And again, no need to be walking through page by page, but just orient.
Mr. Chair and members, I think just there are two, as you say, the one that was just handed out that is labeled Children and Families Human Services HF 2910 has only the human services portions of it. The other spreadsheet has both the K-12 and the human services. So I'll look at just the one labeled 2910. And I think just the first and second page will, this shows the changes, not the base, but the change items the governor recommended. If you see on line 6, you will see the net general fund increase in the governor's budget for this set of changes is $773.9 million in 24-25. And $1,027,744,000 in the tails. If you go down to line 45, you will see the portion of that that is at the Human Services Department that was just described, $766.1 million in 24-25 and $1,027,000.3 in the tails. I'll just note that there are three smaller agencies on line 82, the Ombudsperson for Families, which has an increase of $47,000 in 24-25 and $64,000 in the tails. The Ombudsperson for American Indian Families, which has an increase of $296,000 in 24-25 and $300,000 in the tails. And at the top of page 2, you'll see on line 90 or 91, the Ombudsperson for Foster Care Youth, the governor's rec for an increase of $49,000 in 24-25 and $66,000 for 26-27. That number does not include the issue that we were talking about with Representative Hansen's bill, which is a separate issue. And then at the very or low on that page, you'll see on line 108, Minnesota Management and Budget, and that is the recommendation for the funding for the new Children and Families Agency. This, again, I'll just note, it goes through each of the individual proposals after that in detail. This is for the governor's original budget. There is a supplemental budget coming out, I believe, later this morning.
Yes, so just make sure we're all kind of oriented. So there's the other spreadsheet that says 2023 Legislature Children and Families. On line one, it says early education. That lists That spreadsheet contains both the MDE proposals and the DHS proposals, sort of everything in our budget. But then there's the spreadsheet that Mr. Berg was just going through, which kind of expands the HHS side proposal. So that kind of orients everybody to where we're at. As Mr. Berg said, this is a little bit awkward timing because the administration will be coming out with a supplemental budget a little bit later today. This is just sort of how things lined up. And so we'll be getting information out about that to the extent it affects our budget and additional programming a little bit later on. So what I want to do is have testifiers come up. We'll see if there are other clarifying questions, and then we'll move to the other side of our jurisdiction. Thank you so much to the testifiers for your work. So Chrissy Booker, Brooker, I may not be saying your first name correctly, but please come on up. I'm just going to ask the testifiers to keep things real short if you can, under 2 minutes if possible. But welcome to you, and please identify yourself once you get settled in and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. My name is Kwesi Booker. I'm the Director of Children and Family Services for Hennepin County. We support provisions in House File 2910 that would fund a statewide qualified individual program, support kinship navigation program, and further development of the prevention services array, including motivational interviewing and parents and teachers. As Commissioner Brown indicated, the Family Services Act was passed in 2018 by Congress, and it recognized the importance of prevention, kinship services, in preventing the need for out-of-home placement for children and families. To obtain federal Title IV-E reimbursement for approved services, the state must first submit a prevention services plan approval by the Federal Children's Bureau. If no, there are eligibility requirements regarding the type of programming that is eligible for reimbursement for both kinship navigation and prevention services. MACSA supports expedited development and implementation of prevention and kinship program across the state with the intention of making these important services available within each of our 87 counties and tribal nations. MACSA supports implementing an approved kinship navigation program that meets the Title IV-E clearinghouse requirements, thereby leveraging federal resourcing available while the state continues to explore development of the LSS kinship navigation model.
Thank you so much. Okay, good. Thanks for your testimony. Appreciate it. We've got Suzanne Arntzen next on the same request. And just once you get settled in, identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Suzanne Arntzen. I'm a deputy director with Scott County Human Services, but today representing MACSA, the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Agencies, to express our support for House File 2910, specifically connected to Community Resource Center proposal that provides dedicated funding for community resource centers. Community resource centers is really an umbrella term used to describe a number of different community-based family strengthening program models. So you may hear things like hubs, full-service community schools, family resource centers. In Scott County, in August of 21, we successfully launched 3 family resource centers. And this came after 2 years of community engagement focused on how we improve the health, safety, and well-being of Scott County children and families. This work alone then led to the development of the family resource centers. We were able to do extensive research within our community engagement work and looked at the work across the nation in 37 states that have implemented family resource centers, who found really amazing results, including reductions in child maltreatment, increase in school readiness, and most importantly, increase in family strengthening and protective factors. Currently, our Scott County Family Resource Team includes over 36 partners that come together to serve and provide services in universal locations to provide for the unique needs of children and families. In addition, we have a parent advisory council that consists of Scott County parents with lived expertise that help guide the evolution of this work. Based on the tremendous results we are seeing nationally, there are many other Minnesota counties that are currently exploring implementation, which includes Sherburne, Washington, Hennepin, Polk, Pine, and Otter Tail. Family resource centers or community resource centers really represent a new and innovative opportunity to serve children and families while reducing the negative impacts of child abuse and neglect. Government cannot and should not lead this work independently, but we are a critical partner in supporting community-based prevention. So as representing MACSA, we strongly urge you to consider supporting House File 2910 and the Community Resource Center proposal.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony, and thanks for your work. Appreciate it. Cisa Keller's up next. And once you get settled in, identify yourself and proceed. And I'd say, Claire Sanford, you could feel free to make your way up as well, just that way we'll be having, yeah, please proceed.
Good morning, Chair Pinto and members of the committee. My name is Cisa Keller, and I am the Senior Vice President of Early Childhood Programs at Think Small, where our mission is to advance the quality care and education of children in their crucial years. To be most efficient, my remarks will address both of the Walt Flanagan administrative bills you're hearing today. The degree of concern that Think Small has over the state of the child care sector is at an all-time high. We serve the 7-county metro area and are seeing dramatic changes in the child care supply and the emergence of troubling trends such as a newer trend of closures, center closures, and closure of parent-aware-rated programs. This supply crisis is especially impacting BIPOC children and low-income communities. We cannot talk often enough about how this lack of access, which has reached a crisis level, impacts young children's development and exacerbates opportunity gaps, which lead to later disparities. To turn the situation around, we need big, bold, and transformative changes like what was recommended by the Walt Flanagan Administration-led Great Start Task Force Bill, and the bill by the same name that was the committee heard last week. To that end, we see promise in aligned proposals brought forward by the administration in these bills, including the proposal to establish child care retention payments, a key strategy for retaining supply. The proposals related to the CCAP, including rates, waitlist reprioritization, and funding some additional families to come off the waitlist, which we have seen to grow to depressing levels in recent months. In fact, just this morning, I received the current waitlist numbers for basic sliding fee CCAP families that we administer in Ramsey County. We are currently have a waitlist of over 4,000 children in Ramsey County alone for basic sliding fee. Finally, we are especially appreciative of the investments in early learning scholarships that you will hear in the next bill, though we would like to see the final budget include the full expansion of priority categories included in Representative Coulter's House File 1277. We want to stress the importance of investing as much as possible in CCAP and scholarships this year to move us in the direction of the new benefit systems for children ages birth to five recommended by the task force. It is this system that can deliver the help that children, parents, and early educators so desperately need. Finally, we are also very supportive of the components of the bill that address the child care supply concerns, specifically the Wayfinder and Empower to Educate provisions. We applaud the Walt Flanagan administration's leadership on this issue and look forward to working together to build on these proposals to get Minnesota's children ages birth to five off to the greatest start possible. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Ms. Keller. Thanks for the testimony and for all of your work. And Ms. Sanford, once you get a chance to settle in, please proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Claire Sanford, and I am here on behalf of the Minnesota Child Care Association. As a Great Start Task Force member and an organizational supporter of the Great Start Act, it is wonderful to work with an administration so dedicated to early care and education. We're thrilled to see many proposals that move Minnesota in the direction of the Great Start Task Force recommendations and bill that was heard last week. Quality for children, affordability for parents at a 7% standard, and increased compensation for early educators. In the governor's DHS budget specifically, we are of course very pleased to see restoration of CCAP reimbursement rates to the federal standard after 20 years in the wilderness, and we are incredibly jazzed about the inclusion of child care retention payments. I cannot emphasize enough the need for direct compensation support that is not passed on to families who already cannot pay more. This is also a Great Start Task Force rec that there's operational support for providers. Our members are constantly asking for updates on this section of the legislation specifically because they are very concerned about what might happen to compensation for their staff. The economy and wages have changed since the pandemic, and these supports are crucial. Idaho actually abruptly ended its early educator compensation done with federal dollars last week, and providers have already alerted families that they're going to have to raise tuition immediately to cover that loss, and families are already making decisions that they can no longer afford that. Those are real and immediate impacts we're seeing happen without these compensation supports. The governor's proposals in this budget area, as well as the education bill we'll hear, under the leadership and coordination of a new Department of Children, Youth, and Families, are critical to moving from piecemeal to a piece of pie in honor of this week's Pie Day. Many of these proposals, because I'm a nerd, many of these this week's proposals are in the Great Start Act, which goes even further, establishing a path to the Great Start scholarships that Ms. Keller mentioned, a new single mixed delivery benefit available to all families with children birth to five with concurrent workforce and infrastructure investment. We look forward, MCCA and the broad array of early childhood advocates and practitioners supporting the Great Start Act, look forward to working together to build on the governor's bold foundation with the Great Start Act as a roadmap to bring the task force recommendations to fruition. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Sanford, and thanks for your work in this area. We appreciate it. So is there any other member of the public who wishes to testify? I'll ask that. Okay, so hearing none, I know Representative Hicks had a question, I think, about fiscal issues. Representative Hicks?
Yes, thank you. And I think this is probably a Doug question. Maybe not. But and when I look at the more breakdown by page of all the different programs, in the admin, 32% costs, sometimes it's zero, sometimes it's a cost savings. Can you help me understand how that works? And
the dreaded FFP.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hicks, I can give you a very general description on any individual thing. It would be a department question. There are administrative costs which the federal government shares the cost with us. So that's, and it is usually, you're noting 32%, but there are some other areas where it's a lower percentage. One of them is 25, and in any case, there are, it's typically staffing, and I think also systems costs where the feds will also share the cost. So if there is not a shareable cost, then nothing is there. If it is a shareable cost, there's an offset for federal revenue, which ends up going to the general fund, but we have to account for it to show what the net cost for the general fund is.
And maybe I can help that. I think these lines are all revenue lines, so they sort of are always going to be positive. They're like things that I think is the ones that you're asking about. I'll send it back to you. Representative Hicks, is that helpful?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I was just trying to understand, so I appreciate the clarification.
And just so I can make sure my brain is following this correctly, that where there is that admin FFP, federal financial participation, I think is the name there, there's sort of always an admin cost above that is an actual cost, and it's just that there might be some savings that the federal government is helping to offset. Mr. Berger, am I saying that right?
Yes, and I guess I can further, possibly Representative Hicks is looking at, there are some initiatives at the governor's where several things were rolled up in one, and it would have an offset on the admin costs that in this spreadsheet are disaggregated into individual decision items. In that case, the offset is only carried in the part of the initiative that has the cost, which would be offset. The other parts of it would not show any.
That's a great question, Representative Hickson. Okay, good. Yeah, and I'm really glad, particularly glad you asked that, because so members, so just because we have a lot of first-term members on the committee, so just to orient everybody, in less than 2 weeks, I guess about a week and a half, we will be, I'll be providing my proposed budget for the committee. We'll have a similar version of this spreadsheet with this level of detail. With I'm expecting the administration folks will be happy to hear, expecting a lot of the material that Commissioner Brown walked through will be in that bill. So sort of this is a bit of a preview for portions of what will come up pretty quickly. So and then we'll be having a vote on that in a couple weeks. We're just laying this over for today, but just to kind of orient everybody. So if you do have questions about that process or about kind of how this works, please do speak up, because we'll be doing this in this committee and several others pretty soon. And the other fiscal committees anybody on the committee may be on. So, Mr. Burke, I guess that's a follow-up comment.
Mr. Chair, I'll just point out, I The other spreadsheet that shows both the K-12 and the Human Services side is set up in a different fashion. And if you look at the, page 4 of that, lines 100 through 114 show all the FFP in one place individually based on the initiative. So there's a total in 24-25 of 20.9, almost 21 million in federal offset.
And just confirming everybody, this is on the spreadsheet entitled 2023 Legislature Children and Families. It's the one that combines MDE and DHS. And then, Mr. Berg, you're looking at lines 100 through 114, 100 being the title for that section, and then, federal funds participation, FFP. Okay, so this is a little bit in the weeds, but, of course, we know that the weeds matter, the details matter. So, members, other clarifying questions? Again, there'll be plenty of time to discuss the merits of these proposals as they make their way through. Representative Lesnikar, you have a question.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. And I wanted to ask maybe a question to the commissioner on the child care for the family child care providers. There's a cap on the max, and I wondered their thoughts on discussion if right now, as I understand it, for family child care providers, their own children are counted in their count into the number of children you could serve. For the ratio. So I wondered if the departments looked at that, because there are many in greater Minnesota and rural that do not have access to centers. And so when I look at the number of closures of centers and family-based childcare, it seems to me we should be having a discussion for this great start to look at somebody's children. So if I am pregnant and I want to be a stay-at-home daycare provider, that my infant would go in the count so I couldn't take another infant. And many people in rural Minnesota are waiting 12 to 18 months to find infant care. So I would hope the department in this great start would be looking at, you know, possibilities of if you have two children, maybe your two children don't go in the count, anything beyond that.
I'm going to kind of put this in the same category as Representative Hicks's question earlier, that right now we're looking at the administration's proposal. I will say that if folks have the way the legislature works, right, like if you have an idea of something to pursue, then you introduce a bill, and we can certainly talk about things offline, similar to what Representative Hicks brought up. We'll look for comment from the Inspector General regarding that, a bit of information, but really the topic today is the administration's proposals in front of us. But Inspector General, can you provide a little bit of insight to Representative Lesnikar's question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Kalani Moti, Inspector General at DHS. And I'm confirming this, but I do believe that is being addressed through our child care modernization project when we're looking at all the rules and regulations, which would include the ratio guidelines on that, soliciting input from license holder stakeholders, early childhood experts, and whatnot to put together the recommendations for that. So I do believe that I'll be able to confirm with you afterwards, but I believe that's part of the modernization project, which is currently underway.
And I'll remind Representative Lesnikar and all that we had funded a couple years ago a project to modernize the regulations for child care, both family child care centers. There's a lot going on with that. But I would invite you, Representative Lesnikar, to certainly feel free to follow up with Inspector General and others if you want to pursue that. Okay. Any follow-up item, Representative Lesnikar?
Thank you, Chair Pinto. My only other follow-up is just on the residential treatment centers that's in here, referencing that. And I wondered if the department has any information on somebody testified on the number that the kids that are waiting for the sliding scale fee. I wonder how many children are waiting, if they have any data, children that are waiting for placement for the residential treatment centers for Minnesota right now. And I ask that because there's many hospitals that have children waiting in ERs. And so I wondered if there's any data.
I think that's, and I say, Lesnikar, my understanding is that the reason that is in our, so I'm not sure if there's somebody who can comment on that, because it may be sort of more of a different part of DHS that our committee does not have jurisdiction over. I think it's page 41 of the bill was where I noticed that the qualified residential treatment program is in there. My understanding is that it's just because of the Family First federal legislation that there's a requirement there. But Ms. Summerfield, maybe you can try to help answer the question.
I can try. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jennifer Sommerfeld, the Department of Human Services. Representative Zalesnikar, you've mentioned children's residential and then the basic sliding fee. So are you asking about the child care basic sliding fee piece?
Yeah. Resident Zalesnikar, not asking about, okay, not asking about child care.
Chair Pinto, no, I'm asking about, I just referenced the question on the sliding fee in the sense of asking about also the number of kids for the family child care, but this question is related to the child placement in a qualified residential treatment program. That language is on page 41. I wondered if the department had data similar to the data that they have on how many people in Ramsey County were waiting to be served in the sliding fee program. I wondered how many families are waiting for their child to be placed in a qualified residential treatment program, if they have data on that too.
Yeah, and maybe outside of the, well, Ms. Sommerfeld, if you're able to provide insight into that.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Yeah, Chair. Representative Zalesnikar, we do not have data on that today, but I can go back to the department to get some for you if we have it available.
That would be good. I think, Representative Zalesnikar, that would be a different area of DHS, mm-hmm. Ms. Sommerfeld. Yeah, but we can, as long as you're raising it, we'll ask the department to pass that along to the folks. But that's, although it's in this bill, my understanding it's because of a connection with the federal Families First law, but otherwise we don't have jurisdiction over that particular area. So,
thank you.
Good. Anything further? Oh, we got a couple. Okay, I'm going to go. Representative Keyes Watoon, we'll go to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I will ask folks to keep things quick if you can, because we need to get to the MDE bill.
Yes. But, yeah. Super quick. In relation to Representative Zalesnikar's question, in psychiatric treatment facilities specifically, we heard a bill from Representative Bierman in Commerce yesterday that would require insurance companies to cover that that treatment, and said that that's something that we can look into offline. But I think that for a variety of reasons, there's a long wait list.
Maybe the two of you connect on that. Representative Hicks?
Thank you, Chair. I was just going to say that's a special interest area of mine, and we should connect. Well, I have lots of information.
You've got a couple
about
friends. You all can. So get together and see what you can work on. So, okay, anything else from members? And again, I know this is what we're really doing is just understanding these proposals from the administration. There's plenty of things that the administration is not proposing at this time, but there's plenty that you are proposing, and we really appreciate it. And so members, feel free to pursue other things as well. So thank you. With that, nothing further, the chair lays over House File 2910 as amended for possible inclusion in the committee's budget bill. And then gets us to House File 2565. And maybe Representative Lee, you were so good to do it before me, but I'll ask you if you can move House File 2565 to bring that before the committee.
Sure. Mr. Chair, I move House File 2565 before the committee.
Thank you. And then there is an amendment, again, the A1 amendment, which I think is, yes, the A1 amendment. If you could move that, Representative Lee.
I move the A1 amendment to House File 2565.
Thank you. And Ms. Mock, I think this is just a very technical amendment. So maybe I'm not sure we even need to. I think it's small enough. Unless members have questions to the A1, we can just get the bill in the shape that the administration wishes to propose it. So I'm not seeing any discussion to the motion. So all in favor of approval of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, so that amendment passes. We have House File 2565 before us. Ms. Morse, I know that Assistant Commissioner Bobby Burnham was hoping to be with us but wasn't feeling well. And again, members, I want to direct you. We've gained a few more members since I said this. The January 26th presentation in your packets, and members of the public is online, has a lot of really good information about the administration's proposals in both these areas. Ms. Morse, please proceed with your presentation on the bill and walking us through it.
Mr. Chair, members, Shayna Morse, Assistant Director of Government Relations at the Department of Education. And yes, Assistant Commissioner Burnham sends her regrets. She really wished she could be here today and appreciates the consideration of the things we're going to walk through. Commissioner Jett and Assistant Commissioner Burnham were here back at the end of January, and they did provide a high-level overview of the One Minnesota budget as it relates to early learning in the space of what we cover at MDE. And what you heard there was that there's actually nearly $900 million over the next 4 years being invested in the early learning space. Much of that is through a mixed delivery pre-kindergarten program that invests almost $500 million, as well as $360 million over the next 4 years in early learning scholarships. What I'm going to do today is actually a section-by-section walkthrough, and then we can take questions from there. And I will actually be very quick and and hopefully fairly dry. All right, so starting with Section 1, this section provides that 10.72% of the total Head Start appropriation is designated to tribal Head Start programs before other allocations are made, and that the state Head Start funds may also be used to cover costs associated with program operations or infrastructure. Section 2 is the first of a number of provisions that relate to this targeted mixed delivery early learning model of the public pre-K proposal in the governor's budget. This particular section clarifies that eligible four-year-olds may enroll in public pre-kindergarten programs. Section 3 is another one of those provisions. This section sets the minimum and maximum hours for instruction for a public pre-kindergarten program in terms of what a student receives, which would be between 425 and 850 hours per year. Section 4, this section relates to the per pupil amount of developmental screening aid and proposes an increase of 30% for each age group. This bill was heard, I think, earlier this week. Section 5 establishes a Grow Your Own program for early childhood educator and for teacher licensure shortage areas. This program would provide grant funds to licensed child care programs, school districts and charter schools, Head Start programs, institutions of higher education, and any other community partnerships in this space to support individuals earning the credentials needed to work in the early childhood education field. Examples might be or someone earning a CDA, college degree, or achieving teacher licensure. The language in the bill lays out program parameters, grant procedures, establishes a special revenue account, and requires some reporting to the commissioner. Section 6 and 7 were removed with the amendment. They are carried in the education policy bill as they're both about kindergarten enrollment. Section 8 adds early childhood special education students as eligible to generate free breakfast reimbursement. We believe this is a technical correction, though it does carry a small cost. Section 9 eliminates obsolete statute describing the duties of the State Advisory Council on Early Childhood Education and Care by eliminating responsibilities that have been completed or with due dates that have already passed. Also adds a duty to review and provide input on the Great Start for All Minnesota Children Task Force recommendations. Section 10 establishes the full-day state-funded pre-kindergarten model for eligible four-year-old children using a mixed delivery model, compromise of school-based, Head Start, and community-based licensed center and family child care programs. The program would be effective July 1, 2025 to provide a two-year delay for planning at both the state and local levels. Section 11 outlines the program and provider requirements for this pre-kindergarten program. Those include assessing a child's progress towards early learning standards, establishing a comprehensive program, program content aligned with early learning standards, outlining the number of hours of instructions to be provided, requiring comparable staff salaries to public school staff salaries, requiring a lead teacher to have a bachelor's degree in early education or equivalent, and then also establishing staff to child ratios not to exceed 1 to 10 or 20 per class. Section 12 outlines the requirements of a mixed delivery local program plan for participating providers within each school district boundary. This is focused on coordination among community providers of pre-kindergarten programs. They would be estimating the children to be served, addressing recruitment plans, professional development coordination, and comparable salary planning. Section 13 outlines the funding for each type of eligible program that participates in the mixed delivery pre-kindergarten model, as well as provides some administrative funds. Districts and charters are funded based upon eligible pupils enrolled using the existing funding model for schools that you would also see with VPK or SRP, where students generate ADM, average daily membership, and levy dollars. For Head Start, licensed child care centers, and licensed family-based providers, those are funded at $11,200 for the maximum hours of instruction for the fiscal years 26 and 27 when the program would be first in place. Section 14 outlines student eligibility to participate in the programs. Children are required to meet one of nine criteria. Also clarifies in this section that a sliding fee may be charged for hours beyond 850 and or school age care that's provided. This section 15 keeps the 4,000 voluntary pre-kindergarten seats from expiring in the next biennium until the mixed delivery model is actually formally implemented in the TALES. Section 16 requires financial reporting requirements for preschool programs. Section 17 expands early learning scholarship eligibility to birth to 2 years old and raises the income threshold to 200% of the federal poverty level. Also adds children referred as in need of child protection services is automatically eligible. And then just a note here, this bill together is a combination of both our budget and policy bills. There's different language related to this in those two. This combination bill does take the policy language, which has just a few more changes and more comprehensive. They don't contradict each other, but just a little more comprehensive. Section 18 adds children of incarcerated parents and children in need of or currently receiving child protective services as priority categories for early learning scholarships, as well as those children that are not yet 4 years of age. This section also changes the timeline for families to select a scholarship program from a 10-month selection period to a three-month period. Section 19 provides administrative funding for the Early Learning Scholarship Program and provides that those funds transferred to the special revenue account may be used for family outreach and distribution of scholarships. Section 20 expands the eligibility for English learner revenue to include students that are also receiving early childhood special education services. Section 21 makes clear that parents with children who receive early childhood special education services and are enrolled in Head Start or licensed childcare in a non-resident district may receive those early childhood special education services in the district that their other program or their other early care and education program is in. The clarification would say that the non-resident district will no longer have the ability to either choose whether or not to enter into a tuition agreement, but would be required to provide the services to the child if available, and then they would claim funding for that child as if it was their own resident student. Section 22 clarifies how to determine pupil units for the public pre-kindergarten program and includes a technical correction that is probably outside of this committee's jurisdiction related to how students with disabilities are counted for hours of services in kindergarten. It's just in the same section of the bill, and we didn't parse it out. Section 23 strikes a line of statute related to calculating compensation revenue based on the discontinued voluntary pre-kindergarten numbers, which would no longer be applicable once full public pre-kindergarten is established in the TALES. Section 24, similar, makes clear that the public pre-kindergarten pupils may not be included in calculating declining enrollment, in this case 2026, as we make that transition from VPK SRP to the public pre-kindergarten program. Section 25 is our appropriations. I've already talked about all of the programs that are proposed to have new funding, with the exception of one that I will mention here, this program related to addressing the early childhood teacher shortage. There's a grant program in here that would provide grants to institutions of higher education to support that shortage, and those grants would be able to be used for tuition and other supports for students. Section 26 repeals sections from the current VPK statutes that are being replaced with mixed delivery language, and then you also already heard the amendment that is just including removing two sections that are outside of this committee's jurisdiction, as well as adding in one that was missed related to early learning screening being permissible in a virtual manner.
Ms. Morris, that was quite impressive, impressively done. So thank you so much for that, members. I did want to remind everybody then that there's the spreadsheet that contains both the MDE and both the education side and HHS side budget items for us. It's the one that says 22-23 legislature, children and families. And the first page of it, the first two pages are all the early education items. And then the remaining pages are the services items Mr. Berg was referencing before. So. It's a little bit confusing because we have that second spreadsheet that is HHS only, but hopefully that helps folks and orients them. Ms. Keller, we'd already heard from. Ms. Sanford, you're going to be coming up because we're going to move into public testimony. So please feel free to do that. We have you. Yep. Okay. And then once you get settled in, you identified yourself before, so please feel free to proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. That's right, I'm still Claire Sanford. I'm still here with the Minnesota Child Care Association, and I am pleased to now comment on the governor's early education proposals in the education budget. In the education budget, we applaud the opportunity for licensed child care providers to participate in the Grow Your Own Early Educator Grant Program. That's very exciting and needed, and will support a lot of providers who are already trying to do those things on their own. We are especially supportive of both the early learning scholarship expansions and the additional commitment of nearly $500 million to early care and education over the next 4 years. We desperately need that nearly $500 million commitment, but we need to ensure it is invested in ways that equitably support the entire birth to five system to meet the most pressing needs of our families and our economy. And that's all I have to say about that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the testimony. Thanks for the brevity. And thank you so much for all of your work. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify on the bill? Ask that next. Okay. And members, were there any clarifying questions that folks have either on the text of the bill, on the numbers, et cetera, at all? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a question maybe for the department and nonpartisan staff. Wanted a clarification on page 17 in the section for priority for students and for early learning scholarships.
Yeah, we can. Why don't you ask your question, and we'll see who's right to answer, Representative.
Great. So I'm just looking at line 17.25 to 17.26 on the definition of homelessness. I'm wondering if that's something consistent across all state agencies. And then I guess the other question, maybe for nonpartisan staff who've looked at a lot of the bills that have gone through our committee, I'm just wondering if there have been bills that, I mean, have changed the definition of homelessness, because I think there's movement for that. So I wanted to look at the comparison between this definition and some of the proposals we've heard.
We've lost Ms. Punelli, who was here, and would be our particular expert on that, because that was kind of on the HHS side. But I don't know if it looks. And Representative Lee, just to confirm, you're talking about 1725 to 1726. Is just that's existing statute, existing law. But you just asked them about kind of how homelessness is defined?
Yeah, so I was wondering if this was a practice across state agencies to use the federal definition of homelessness, which would have been the question for the agency.
I'm not sure if we have some, if Ms. Morse happens to know. We're kind of think that maybe it's probably for, I think McKinney Vento has to do, well, Ms. Morse, let's.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, I can't speak to state agencies collectively, but in the education space, this is the federal law that's pretty consistently referenced. I'm not aware of any other definition that's used in the space of education.
And I think McKinney-Vento is the law that requires that districts provide transportation for kids experiencing homelessness. So it's a kid-focused definition of homelessness. And Mr. Keeler was helping me out with that as well. So Representative Lee, follow up?
That's it.
Okay. Members, other clarifying questions about the bills or about the numbers or anything else? So not seeing anything. I'll thank the MD staff for putting this together and for your work as well. And I'll maybe just note, so again, members, actually maybe it is worthwhile to just quickly walk through this. So the week of I would expect our budget bill to be released the week of the 27th. And we'll be walking through it, receiving testimony, receiving amendments, and voting it out all that week. So that's on the 27th of March, just so we're clear about the month. So coming up pretty fast. So if you have input, thoughts about anything that we've been covering, and in particular these bills, I'll say full disclosure, I would expect to have a substantial portion of these proposals be in our committee budget, depending on the target that we receive from leadership. And that is approved in the Ways and Means Committee, and so would invite members to really dive into the details here, because they'll be making their way back. I'm just seeing if there's anything else from anybody, and then otherwise just a preview for next week. So with that, the chair lays over House File 2565 as amended for possible inclusion in our budget bill. And then members, next week is our final two hearings before we go through budget bills. Tuesday will be one addressing homelessness in particular. I want to give a heads up that please expect that we may well go until 10:15 on both Tuesday and Thursday. This is to make sure we can fit in everything we need to and do not have to schedule an extra hearing, which I'm sure none of you wants to have to do. So we will try to extend the calendar event out to make sure that it extends to 10:15, but please keep an eye on that and try to not have things that conflict with that. Trying to see if there's anything else. So any other questions, anything from members? And otherwise, you get a little bit of time back this morning. Thank you so much to the members of the administration for your work and coming to be with us. With that, members, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.